market. So we saw this, the scales tip again in the 70s and 80s, and we saw a massive wave of consolidation because we had really light antitrust regulation, and we got right back to where we were 100 years ago.
So was there something more active? I mean, you mentioned this light antitrust regulation. Was policy changed? Were laws kind of withdrawn? What happened?
It's a great question. I think there were two important parts of it. First of all, what was happening in the background was that companies like Tyson Foods were industrializing the meat system. For the first time, they were raising animals in a factory-type environment. That had never happened before, and it really did make meat cheaper. It brought big savings. You can get these economies of scale when you don't have a lot of little slaughterhouses. You build one giant mega slaughterhouse. That's what these companies were doing. So what they could argue, Tyson Foods could turn around to antitrust regulators and say, hey, we're making meat cheaper. And this mindset started to really become dominant in the 80s that as long as companies were saving people money, we could let them become monopolies. Walmart, perfect example. Walmart could argue, hey, we're destroying competition throughout rural America. We're taking over downtown Main Street, but we're making things cheaper for the consumers. So therefore, it's okay if we consolidate this business. In my opinion, that means we were forgetting the lessons of the past, that when you let a few companies get dominant market control, guess what? They use their market power. It's sort of common sense, but we forgot that lesson, and we're seeing the fruits of it happen today. Now, I said there was a second part to it, and that is the fact that I consider the antitrust efforts like the Packers and Stockyards Act I just mentioned, it's sort of like a statue that's in the middle of the park. And over 100 years, vandals just start breaking it apart, writing on it, shaving it down, rubbing it down. And 100 years later, it's totally unrecognizable. That's what company lawyers have done to the Packers and Stockyards Act over decades. They've beaten it back, made it toothless, and it's really kind of unrecognizable from what it was.
Mm-hmm. So you talk about this sort of, this industrialization, increased efficiency. What's the problem with vertical integration, increased efficiency within the chicken industry?
Yeah, this is a great question. First of all, you know, on its face right off the bat, there's not an inherent problem with this. Contract farming and vertical integration, and let me please define that really quickly. Vertically integrated company, what that means is it owns all the aspects of production. A big Tyson Foods plant contains within it all the things that used to be independent businesses on Main Street. It's got a big feed mill. It's got a big hatchery. It's got a big slaughterhouse. It's got a trucking line. It's all been sucked into one corporate entity. And then they contract out with farmers and effectively control the farmers. That can achieve great efficiency. It lets these companies coordinate production almost down to like the chicken, the number of eggs they put on the farm. The problem comes when you let companies integrate a business like this from top to bottom, and then you let them become enormous and buy out all of their competitors. That's when the situation becomes really toxic because they have control and power vertically from top to bottom, and then they've purchased out their competitors, so they have horizontal control over markets. Today, Tyson Foods makes about 22% of all the chicken in the United States. No company has ever had that kind of market share before. And just to give a concrete example of why that matters, you got a guy or a gal in a small town in Missouri who's under contract with a company like Tyson, they don't have a choice anymore of who to do business with. So if these companies start putting the screws to farmers as they are, now that we've let competition go by the wayside, the farmers don't have a choice. They have to put up with what the company dictates. So that's the problem. It's letting companies integrate from top to bottom and then letting them buy out their competitors and become mega firms.
And that's what you mean when you say it's kind of a modern day sharecropping system.
That's exactly what I mean. These farmers, how it works is, a couple in a small town will borrow anywhere from $500,000 to $2 million to build a giant factory farm. So they're heavily indebted. And then they sign a contract with a company like Tyson. And Tyson will deliver the chickens to their farm, deliver the feed to their farm, send trained veterinarians by the farm to check on the animals. But the farmer never actually ever owns the chickens. And they never own the feed. They don't have control over their operations. They're just raising these animals under the company's exacting specifications and hoping they get paid enough at the end of the day to make ends meet. This arrangement of the farmer being heavily indebted, signing a contract with a company, actually did really trace its roots from the sharecropping system in the South back in the 30s and 40s. They borrowed the ideas, the way to finance this and the way to structure it from sharecropping and tenant farming.
So let's kind of turn a bit to the opposition to the book, namely the from the industry. They've described the book as a hit piece with no solutions offered. So I'm curious, what do you want to see happen with the meat industry? What are the solutions?
That's a great question. First, I'd like to kind of take that apart bit by bit. But they say that there are no solutions offered, but the book traces a clear history of people who have tried to rein in the corporate power of these giant meat packers and have been beaten back again and again. I detail a really vigorous antitrust fight in Iowa, where that state attorney general tried to stand up to the big vertically integrated pork producers, and they fought him tooth and nail and beat him back. And then you see how the Obama administration came into office, tried to do similar antitrust efforts. So the solutions are clear. It's not what the National Chicken Council wants to hear, which is that their biggest clients should probably be broken apart because their business strategy today is based on monopolistic abuse. But that a solution is clearly laid out in the book through the history. You know, same token, I'm a journalist and I'm just describing what happens. I don't write legislation. I'm not a policymaker, and there's no chapter in the book where I say, here's the solution to this problem. But any intelligent reader can see clearly what the solutions and what the problems are as they read it. Now, for the Chicken Council to call this a hit piece is, well, maybe it makes me think they didn't read the book, because half the book is the inside story of Tyson Foods as told through the people who built the company. And it shows how they think, how they operate. It's not like this is a one-sided story. This is the full and true picture of how these firms came to be and how they operate.
Well, it seems like you, at times, it's almost flattering, you know, because the way they navigated the system was pretty, you know, ingenious.
No question about it. I mean, I'm a business reporter, and, you know, 45% of this book is just a remarkable business story. I say in the book, I'll say it anywhere, Don Tyson, the guy who really made Tyson Foods what it is today, is a genius. I mean, I got to interview him twice, and I think it's one of the few times in my life I've been in the same room with a genius. I think he was a brilliant, amazing person. That doesn't mean that his company should have untrammeled power and dominant control over markets. I don't blame him for what he was doing. He was a really smart guy. He wanted to make a fortune. He explicitly stated to his partner his goal in life was to make $50 million by the time he was 50 years old. He surpassed that by a factor of many. But, you know, that was his goal. And I think society needs to step back and look at what's best in the public interest at the same time.
So that kind of leads us to the takeaway. As individuals, as consumers, what does this mean for us?
Right. First of all, I think the point of the book is that if you buy commercial meat at the grocery store, you cannot effectively opt out of this system. You know, no, these companies own dozens and dozens of different brand names. You're basically buying from four companies when you shop at the grocery store and buy meat. And I shop at the grocery store and buy meat. Let me say that right off the bat. I'm a journalist, which means I'm very poor. And I eat meat, and I cannot afford to get all of my meat from a local farmer's market, although I do get some. And that brings me to the next thing. Any consumer these days can opt out of the system by buying meat from a local producer. There is an incredible wave of entrepreneurial energy and activity on behalf of these local livestock and poultry producers. They are incredible people. I get a lot of my chicken from a local farmer in Maryland where I live, and you can visit the farm. You can ask them questions. Every dollar you spend goes directly to that farmer. It's a great system. That being said, I don't think it's fair to ask every American to opt out of our meat system, to buy meat that's, you know, safe and affordable, and to know that their dollars are not going to a system that exploits farmers. I think when you have monopolies gain power, you need to address that through a public approach, a broad public approach. And we have a right to scrutinize and address problems in the giant industrial meat system that provides Americans about 95% of their meat, as opposed to the smaller alternative models you can go to for the locally produced food.
Yeah, great. Chris Leonard, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for the time. I really appreciate it.
This is The Food Show on KBOO. That was Christopher Leonard talking about his book, The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Industry. During the interview, Christopher Leonard told a story about a time he randomly ran into Don Tyson when he was eating at a hotel restaurant in Arkansas. Now, we didn't have enough time to play that on the air today, but that story is going to be released through the Underground Airwaves series. You can find more about information about Underground Airwaves, which is a food story series, on the Edible Portland website. And I also wanted to mention, speaking of Edible Portland, we had Tammy Parr on the show last month, and she is featured in the newest Edible Portland, which is now on the newsstands. So I'm going to turn it over to Kate.
Yeah, and I have a couple of facts and figures that you might enjoy, having just listened to some talk about meat. Hamburger, for example, is roughly 18% protein and 18% fat, while cooked grasshoppers contain up to 60% protein and just 6% fat. And insect farming is also more efficient than cattle production. 100 pounds of feed produces 10 pounds of beef, while the same amount of feed yields 45 pounds of cricket. So just a little research informs us that insects are a staple part of the human diet for thousands of years, and people around the globe do eat insects, especially in tropics, places like Thailand, Africa, and Mexico. When I mentioned this fact to my friend Yvonne, she started to tell of the special dishes from her native Mexico, so I asked her to come on the food show and tell us more about some of the insects in Mexican cuisine. This interview with Yvonne Rivero was recorded in a KABU studio.
Thank you for coming on the food show today, Yvonne.
Thanks for inviting me here, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here at the food show, one of my favorites in KABU.
And what's on your menu today?
Well, actually, this comes from observation and experience. I'm not really sure if I'm a foodie or not, but yes, I am interested in keeping a diversified table, let's say. And therefore, I am researching a lot into the herbs, the plants that you can find around yourself, you know, in the wild, and sometimes even in our yards, mm-hmm. that are edible. Because I think we need to keep more in contact with a diversity of food sources. And, of course, of protein.
So
and
we are going to focus on insects.
So. On insects.
You gave me this long list.
Right. Among those, we have escamoles.
Escamoles.
Right. And this is actually a worm.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I'll tell you a little bit more about where you find these and how I came into contact with all of these. My actual experience has been in both in the U.S. and in Mexico. And for me, discovering these things was like amazing. The people ate these things, you know, in the open. They're in the markets. You go by a market and then you see like this fountains of round things moving around, you know, the worms, different colors and stuff. And people buy them, you know, and they eat them. Eating insects is popular in tropical places, although I have to say that from my experience, I have seen people eating these different kinds of insects in habitats that are different from the tropical. For instance, in the Valley of Mexico, where there can be alternating hot and cold and it's not humid, there's a long, long tradition dating back to pre-Hispanic times in which people integrate these insect sources into their daily living. The Valley of Texcoco, before it became the desert that it is right now, it used to be a thriving lake with thousands of species. After it was dried up in the 60s and the 70s, people there, they were so poor that they ate, they gather mosquito larvae and mosquito eggs and made patties out of it. And this is well known all around. And so this is what really piqued my attention when I was like, you know, 10 or 12, that people could get nutrition, you know, from these different sources. In the Western mind, you wouldn't even think about it. And yet these are traditions that sustain people for thousands and thousands of years.
Some of those dishes are highly prized, though, too.
They're becoming now because, as we know, the Mexican cuisine that is now part of humanity's heritage, patrimonio, as it's said in Mexico, it's recognized worldwide as a source of nutrition around the world. So the next thing on my list is the chapulín. And the chapulines, this is a grasshopper. People eat it, for instance, in Oaxaca and Chiapas, the southern states in the Pacific Rim. You know, you find them in the markets in Mexico as well. They look red. You actually see the grasshopper, you know, about an inch in size. And they're already, I think they're toasted. So you can go around and, you know, basically grab a couple of tortillas and put them in the middle with some salsa, and they're good. They're really delicious. You know, you can also add nopales, which is the cactus leaves, to your wet pico. I mean, tomatoes and diced onions, and you can add some serrano pepper.
I'm getting hungry.
I know. It's really fabulous. So there's the chapulines. And then there's other type of insect that I know. It's the, there's this huge worms that grow in the maguey. You know, this is the agave. The agave that is so popular or so seen. And it's almost a symbol of everything that's Mexican. I don't remember the scientific name for it. But they're big worms. These ones live at the root of the maguey.
Oh.
Right? And this is the worm that you find. If you know of Mexican traditions, you'll know about this liquor that is produced in the state of Oaxaca. Mezcal.
M-E-Z-C-A-L.
M-E-Z-C-A-L. Right. This is a strong, distilled, it's not a liquor, it's a spirit. Yeah. It's a spirit, and it's used for many religious and important celebrations. Its focus is in the state of Oaxaca. And this is the drink where you find the worm there. And so you have that worm, and then there's still another variety, and they come from this plant. You know,
from the it's roots the, of the plant.
From the roots, yeah. Many times the roots are infested by this kind of worm. Usually you'll see the little ones at the bottom already pickled.
In the bottom of the mezcal.
In the bottle of the mezcal, right. And it's sometimes a challenge to eat that worm. So this is just a preliminary to what I was going to tell you about this other type of worm that is really huge, you know, compared to this worm, which is about an inch.
There's the mezcal worm is just about an inch.
Right.
But the worm you're going to tell us about is huge.
It's huge. It could be about 3 inches in length. It does look like a caterpillar.
What's the name of that one?
This is the gusano de maguey.
Yes, I looked that up, and it is moth larvae.
It is moth larvae. Yeah. Okay. So they get this once, and again, you can find this on the market. As a Westerner, I was always felt repugnant looking at the worm in its natural state. You can find them in markets. The more you go like to the traditional markets, to small town markets, they are there.
Do you know how they prepare them?
I'll tell you a story of how I got to know this.
Okay.
And how I ate my first
Can't worm. Wait. It looks like a fun one.
What was my first experience with this? I used to report for one of the top newspapers in Mexico in the social and gastronomy pages and stuff. And we were invited then to a Mexican festival at Focolare, which at the time was one of the best Mexican restaurants in town in Mexico City. So the appetizer was gusano de maguey with tequila. And I couldn't believe it. When they brought the handmade tortillas and they brought this little crunchy long things and everybody was eating them, I had to eat as well. And they were delicious. They're a delicacy. I mean, it's incredible. From what I understand from talking to the chefs there, you get the living creature and fry them. And then just add salt.
And they're very high in fat, so you don't need to even add fat to them.
Right. Well, this ones I had were, you know, slightly toasted on the, or sauteed, let's say. And there were about 4 per person. And then the way I had them was with tequila. And so this was an appetizer and tortillas, handmade tortillas, blue tortillas that time. And it was incredible. I mean, incredible. What to me is really interesting is that when you really get the experiences of chefs that have this experience of food and sources of food from outside of the Western idea, it enriches your experience of the world and then the experience of what you eat, you know, and what people have eaten through generations.
You would not have eaten that worm if it had just been put on the plate in front of you here at cable radio, but in that situation where you were, you ate it and it was delicious.
It's fantastic, you know, and I would eat them any other time if I could get a hold of them. People who are listening to this, you know, may or may not think this is a good idea, but at the same time, you know, this sharing of something that people from the earth had been doing, you know, and when I say to the earth, it's close to the farmland, you know, and they've been doing this for a long time.
These are traditional foods.
And these are traditional foods. And this is how people who only eat, for instance, or they don't have a lot of sources of nutrition anyway, you know, you eat probably your beans and your squash and corn, you know, and then you add on whatever else you find. So like, for instance, you know, if there's nothing else, then you could probably eat snake or monkey, you know, which people do in Mexico. Armadillo, you know, this is done in the Southwest here in the States. So I'm thinking about, you know, different sources and eating things that are more natural and different sources of nutrition and staying close to the roots. I have one more. The other experience that I had is in the town of Taxco in the state of Guerrero in Mexico. This is an incredible sort of medieval kind of town where there's silversmiths. You know, this is the big business in town, silversmithing. There is an interesting practice there. There's bugs, flying bugs that resemble, I think they're some sort of scarab, and they fly. People here, they say that there's times when they fly in such big number that you can raise your hand and you grab this and then just put them in your tortilla and then there you go. You have a taco.
Eat them live.
You eat them live, yeah.
What kind of a bug is that?
Okay, this is actually humiles. Humiles are spelled in Spanish, J-U-M-I-L-E-S, humiles.
J-U-M-I-L-E-S. Oh, right. Yeah. Okay, right. You told me about them before.
Right, and then these humiles... Ah. Especially in the town of Taxco, but around, you know, which Taxco is a resort.
Could they look like they're kind of stink bug.
They look like a stink bug, exactly. But what I do want to tell you is that these products are becoming part of the great influx of Mexican cooking around the world. And I'm sure that there will be a way of obtaining them dry or so. Because here comes the real gem. The gem of these places is that there is a salsa that is made with the bug. And then so chapulines, for instance, they're also integrated into some of the salsas from Oaxaca, for instance. You know, there's so many types of salsa, but then in this one, you know, they have like dried chilies, then it's made in this lava mortars, and then they're crushed. And the flavor is just fantastic. So you could eat, you know, basically just tacos de salsa.
And get your protein because of the percentage of protein that's in these
critters.
After this conversation with you, I might be able to take the next step, which would be to start eating some of these things because I have never eaten them.
It takes a lot, I think, to transcend, you know, the feeling
of... The first bite.
The yuckiness, right?
Wow. Cool. Thank you, Yvonne, for being on the KABU Food Show.
Thank you, Kate. It is an honor to be here.
And that was Yvonne Rivero. I spoke with her in a KABU studio. I wanted to thank KBOO intern Jenny for helping with that recording. And you are listening to The Food Show on KBOO Radio.
Well, that opened up a whole new world of food. And now we're going to talk about water issues and the drought. I'm not sure about insects' water requirements, but maybe that's a good alternative.
Some snakes probably don't need as much as others.
Yeah, maybe it's a good alternative for drought-stricken regions. So I spoke with Heather Cooley, the director of the water program for the Pacific Institute. The Pacific Institute, based in Oakland, California, works to change policy and create a healthier planet and sustainable communities through their research. So here on the West Coast this year, we're experiencing extreme drought, breaking historical records. How severe and unprecedented is this drought?
It is certainly a severe drought. It is really of historic proportions. We often talk about the sort of 1976-1977 drought as being among the most severe, and we are, in some parts of California, it's worse than that drought, but in others, it's tracking a little bit better. But, you know, overall, it is a drought that's impacting the entire, all of California, and of course, parts of Oregon and in Nevada. And so it is a very severe drought. We've had very low precipitation, very little snowpack. The snowpack is about 20 or 25% of for normal at this time of year. So it is a major concern.
You testified in court regarding the issues of climate change and agriculture. What did your testimony consist of?
Well, in that testimony, I talked mostly about the potential impacts of climate change on agriculture, of which there are many. Increased temperature will have an impact on where we grow crops and the water requirements and issues around pests and pest prevalence. One of the major impacts that will affect agriculture is impacts on water resources. Water is obviously a major input for agriculture, and in most areas we are irrigating. In some areas we're using precipitation, but we often supplement that with irrigation. And climate change will have major impacts on water resources, both on the quality of water, the timing, and the amount of precipitation. And that, of course, will affect agriculture in a real way.
The drought is especially severe in the Central Valley, one of the most productive agricultural areas in the world. How has the drought affected food and agriculture in the Central Valley so far this year?
Well, it's now really that farmers are making some of their planting decisions, so decisions about what to plant and how much. And so we are likely to see fallowing of crops. I think it's widely recognized that we are in a drought. We don't have the amount of water that we typically have for agriculture, and so agriculture will get less surface water, as will many urban areas. But we're likely to see fallowing as a result. We're likely to see increased pumping of groundwater in California. In California, agriculture uses both surface water and groundwater. And so when surface water is limited, people tend to use more of that which is available, which is groundwater. We're also likely to see some transfers, of water from those who may have it to those who are willing to pay or are able to pay for it.
What impact will it have on the environment when farmers start using groundwater sources?
Well, the drought in and of itself will have major impacts on the environment, in large part because there really isn't sufficient water in streams and in rivers. And so as a result, there are already concerns about salmon that are in rivers being able to migrate out to the ocean, and then salmon that are in the ocean being able to return back up to spawn. In addition to low water levels, though, we also have much warmer temperatures of the water, and so that can have an impact on fish and wildlife as well. Greater pumping of groundwater, of course, will impact streams and reservoirs as well. Of course, groundwater provides a water source for streams and reservoirs, and so as more water is pumped from groundwater, it's very possible that'll reduce the amount of water the even limited amount of water we have available in our streams and rivers.
The governor is asking people to voluntarily reduce their use of water. Is he expecting this from farmers as well? And are there farmers that are willing to do this?
Well, the governor has called for a voluntary reduction in water use, and water agencies and water utilities across the state have in some cases asked for voluntary, but in some cases also for mandatory restrictions, either restrictions of 10 or 20%. And as the drought becomes more severe, or as over the summer as water supplies and continue to dwindle, we'll likely see more reductions or more mandatory restrictions put in place. There have been limits. So generally the way it works in California, for those farmers that receive water from either the state water project or the Central Valley project, the Central Valley is the federal project, they receive certain allotments, and the state and federal government have already announced that they will be reducing the amount of water available for farms and for farmers for crops. And so, that will certainly impact agriculture. It'll impact the types of crops that they're growing. They're likely to be fallowing in some areas. So it's not so much that they're calling for voluntary restrictions from agriculture, but more that they simply won't be able to deliver all of the water that they typically are able to deliver in a wetter year.
What crops are particularly susceptible and impacted by the drought?
Well, the impacts of the drought will depend in part on the type of crop, but also in large part based on the water rights that you have. So, we have junior rights and senior rights here in California, and the senior right holders are those who have been using water for a very long time. The right system is sort of a first in time, first in right. And so the senior water rights holders are more likely to get their full allocation of water from both the Central Valley and the State Water Project. The junior water rights holders are less likely, and in fact may not get water at all from either the state or federal project. So it's not simply about sort of what crops you have, but it's more, the impacts are more a function of what types of rights that you have to the water. There are, though, differential impacts on crops. So there are permanent crops which require water every year. So, vineyards, orchards, those types of things. And then there are more the annual crops. So things that are planted every year. The permanent crops require water every year. And so if they are farmers with those types of crops do not have adequate water, they will either be forced again to pump groundwater, to buy water on the market if they're able to find willing sellers, or they may be forced to cut some of those trees down.
Are there certain crops that are resistant to drought that farmers might be wanting to plant?
Well, there's certainly differential water requirements depending on the crop. And in some cases, there are crops grown in California that are dry farmed. And so those ones obviously tend to have deeper rooting systems. They will not be as impacted as some of the other crops that need to be irrigated every year.
I also wanted to talk about livestock in the region. Is there a lot of ranching and livestock down in that region?
There is some, and there is absolutely a concern about the impacts on ranching. It really didn't start raining here until February and in the beginning of March. And so if you looked out on pastures, there really just wasn't any green. Everything was really dead. And so as a result, ranchers had to supplement their feed. They had to purchase alfalfa. They had to purchase other types of feed for their animals, which certainly increases the cost. We were fortunate enough to get some rain again in February and in March. We did see some of the areas greening up a little bit, and that can be feed for those animals. But it's not going to last long. And so, you know, those ranchers are going to have to purchase supplemental feed, and there has been questions about the availability of that and certainly the cost.
How would you compare the water usage for agricultural crops versus livestock?
That's an interesting question, although not one that I really have a great answer for. You know, I think in general, livestock don't require a lot of water. The animals don't drink a lot of water, yet we do use a lot of water to grow their feed. And so the impact wouldn't necessarily be directly on the animal, per se, but on the either the ability to produce feed or the cost of that feed. When we do look at sort of differential response on crops, certainly the type of irrigation method that's used has an impact on the amount of water used for a crop. So we still have very large areas in California that are irrigated using flood irrigation. That's a relatively inefficient form of irrigation. It does require more water than if those similar crops were grown with either drip or micro sprinklers. And so there is sort of a differential impact or differential use of water from various crops depending on the irrigation method that's used.
You've done work on agricultural water conservation and efficiency. What are some of the most important areas and topics that you have been working on?
So there are a number of ways that we can improve the efficiency of agriculture. One is through adopting more efficient irrigation technologies. So surface drip or subsurface drip irrigation has shown to use less water than some of the less efficient irrigation methods. Microsprinklers as well, those have found to be very efficient compared to some of the traditional sprinklers and again, flood irrigation. In addition to changing the irrigation technology, there are also ways of improving irrigation scheduling. So there are a variety of ways farmers can use to determine when to irrigate and how much to use. But in recent years, there's been really a proliferation of new technologies, of new research that shows that that can help farmers determine how much water is needed by the crop and when it's needed. There have been developments in soil moisture sensors and weather-based irrigation controllers. So there are a number of new technologies out there that can really help farmers. In addition, there are some other practices. There's deficit irrigation. Deficit irrigation is a technique that can be used, and using that, it really recognizes that certain crops have some drought-tolerant stages, and so during those drought-tolerant stages, you can actually stress the plant or apply less water than would be typically required, and the plant is able to survive, and in some cases, the actual plant produces a better quality of product. This is a practice that has been commonly used on wine grapes, for example, but it can be used on other types of crops, including on tomatoes. It can be used on some stone fruit, peaches, apricots, those sorts of things, and it can also be used on some citrus crops.
Have you seen a lot of these concepts and technologies being applied?
There are some. There are certainly some very innovative farmers here in California and in other regions that are experimenting with these and with other even more innovative approaches. So yes, we are seeing it. Of course, we can be doing better. There's still about 40% of the crops in California that are grown using flood irrigation. Still, irrigation scheduling, the most common method, is really based upon the sort of look of the plant or of the feel of the soil. So there are opportunities there. And deficit irrigation is certainly not universal. There are more farmers that could be applying that technique.
There are a variety of water agencies. How are the decisions being made to allocate water?
Well, the decisions are often made first by the state and by the federal government through their various allocations. So as I mentioned, there are allocations that are put out, and that determines how much water individual farmers or individual irrigation districts will receive. Those come out periodically. They make announcements of what the allocations will be. They generally are after the snow surveys have been done, once we have a better sense of how much water is available. So there were some preliminary numbers that came out in March. We'll see some new ones come out in April. So that'll really determine sort of the allocation, at least at the broad state level. And then the allocation within irrigation districts is really going to vary based on sort of the policies and practices of that particular irrigation district. In addition to that, though, that we do offer, there are market transfers available. So in some cases, there may be willing sellers who are able to sell their water for a short term, say for a year, to help other farmers perhaps that don't have water, that may have permanent crops that they need to irrigate. And so there are opportunities available to purchase water as well.
You've studied the hydrologic impacts of climate change. What type of trends are you seeing, and how do you see things working out in the next couple of years?
Well, the models about precipitation generally suggest that, or are really inconclusive about whether California will be wetter or drier. Some models suggest it'll be a little bit wetter, some suggest a little bit drier. But what they are in agreement on is that the snowpack will be smaller. Because of warmer temperatures, we'll see more precipitation fall as rain rather than snow. So that means that during the wintertime and during the spring, we're likely to see more flooding. But it also means that because we have a smaller snowpack, and the snowpack is sort of our largest natural reservoir in the state, because we have a smaller snowpack, we will have less water available to sort of refill our reservoirs, and therefore less water available during the summer and during the fall when we need it. Now, there are some management practices we can do to help us adapt to these sorts of changes. We haven't made them yet, but I argue that we can, and we certainly should start.
Is this drought particularly affecting smaller farmers?
I would say it's more likely, yes, that it would be impacting. But again, it's really dependent on the types of rights that they have, whether they have senior rights or junior rights, and whether they have access to groundwater.
What would a graph of urban water usage versus agricultural water usage look like?
Yeah, so about 80% of the developed water supply in California is for agriculture. The remaining 20% is for our urban areas, our cities. And so within our cities, that includes our homes, our businesses, our industries, those types of things. So the vast majority is for agriculture, although generally agricultural water use has been relatively constant. We've seen some minor upticks here and there. Urban use overall has increased, or is increasing, due to continued population and economic growth. Although I will note that the per capita water use is declining. That's the amount of water we use per person, and that's in part because of efficiency improvements.
You're listening to KBOO. That was Heather Cooley, director of the water program for the Pacific Institute, talking about the drought.
So we don't quite have enough time for the story by James Beard Award-winning chef Andrea Rusing. Now, you can still listen to that. It is available online. If you go to iTunes, search Underground Airwaves, you will find that story. It's a great story. It kind of fits in with our sort of meat theme of today. It's a first slaughter that she went to and experienced. But we do have a moment. This is kind of the time of the year when people are planning their gardens, getting ready to, you know, really sort of dream up, getting ready to engage with the outdoors again and create food for the year. And so we wanted to kind of go around and have a bit of a roundtable discussion about what's going on in your garden And we're going to start with Kate. Kate, what is going on in your garden?
Yeah, what is going on in my garden? My garden has changed again this year, as frequently happens in my life. And I now have a couple of containers on a balcony. And my my sun exposure is I have morning sun, and it goes away early in the afternoon. So it's going to be an interesting experiment. But I do have a planter box that I put some radish seeds in and some pea seeds because I had them. And I think that lettuce will probably do okay, especially as the summer goes on, and we'll be looking for some shady afternoons. But the radishes are up. And I'm also starting a potato bin. So I've never done that before. I've always put my potatoes in the ground, but it is what I can do. I'm going to try that.
Well, what does a potato bin look like?
Looks like a recycling bin with hay and a little bit of with coffee grounds and eggshells and other things that I don't feed the chickens, because I do take my compostables to my daughter's chickens in exchange for eggs, but I don't give the chickens eggshells, so I dry the eggshells and put that in my my potato bin. You know, I think that we've talked about this before. Barbara Damrosch talked about growing potatoes in a barrel, and I know of other people that have done that. It's kind of like, I think it's mostly going to be straw.
Yeah, and it seems like it's something that you can do if you don't have a lot of space. I mean, you think of potatoes as taking up a lot of space, but they really do want to grow vertically. And if you can kind of creatively create that vertical environment for them. I mean, I think we talked on that show too about using tires and gradually stacking on tires as the potato plant grows and then stuffing it with hay.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually when you're done, you just knock over all the tires and there's all
and
your potatoes.
And you've got all your potatoes. Yeah. You know, and it's also the kind of thing that, okay, if I don't stay in this place, I can pick up my potato bin and take it with me.
Sure. Peter, what do you got going on?
Well, I actually live in an apartment, so I don't have a lot. But I do have some plans to do some renovations on my friend's garden and my parents' garden. Mostly this season, I'm thinking berries. They're really easy to fit into your diet if you're not used to eating a lot of vegetables from your garden. Also, I tend to get most of my vegetables at the farmer's market or, honestly, QFC. But, so I don't know, pretty much just easy plants. Just I'm trying to get more into gardening, so, you know, just something that hopefully will stay alive, looks nice, easy to maintain. Right now, most of my time is spent just dealing with blackberries and trying to get them off the fence. Well, particularly off of my neighbor's side of the fence, because I like them. What about you, Rachel? Are you growing anything?
I'm trying to keep it simple. I really want to focus on herbs. I want to do some culinary herbs and some more unusual medicinal herbs as well. So I'd like to try to grow some herbs that are a little more difficult to grow. So we'll see how that works out. I want to try to do false unicorn root, which is a really amazing medicinal herb.
What does it do? I've never heard of it.
It's it's really good for women in general. And it's been used throughout a lot of the native tradition, but it's been really over-harvested. And it's, like I said, it's hard to grow, so
Can you say what it is again?
False unicorn root.
Unicorn root.
Yeah.
Oh, I've never heard of it.
Yeah. Sounds like wolf's
bane. Where does it originally grow native to?
I think it's all around the country in really dense wooded areas, from what I recall.
So do you have to have
false
a shader over that?
Root.
Well, I have, I just moved into a new house with a nice backyard that has some shaded areas, so there's a lot of ivy growing there in the area. I might dig up a little ivy and try to replace it with some of those herbs. Awesome. Like the deep forest.
I hope people are getting some ideas here. There's that. I mean, that's new to me, and I feel like I've been growing things for a while. So false unicorn root and the growing potatoes in a bin or something vertical.
I just think that's such a great idea, not having to dig them up later. Because, like, that's the hardest part about potatoes is they're under the ground. Like, any other plant you harvest, there they are.
Right, yeah. I think the harvest is, it's just like an exciting moment. It's kind of like when you have, like, the dominoes and you sort of tip them over and you get to watch them. You've, like, set up this big track of dominoes. It's kind of like that. You just get to see these potatoes fall out, and then you're eating them.
I lament the fact I've spent so many hours like setting up dominoes before we had video cameras everywhere. Now, I mean, you know, setting up the potatoes, you have something to show, but dominoes, you just got to pick them up.
Sure. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You don't get to eat the dominoes. So I guess, yeah, I've mentioned on here before that we've got a farm, and so we've actually got hoop houses up at our place. And this year I wanted to push as early as possible if we could grow beets and carrots. And so I'm excited. I planted beets and carrots and have been keeping them watered. The soil, because we've had some sunny days, has been pretty warm, so they germinated. So I've got these really small baby beet and carrot plants. The concern now is that when the slugs find them or the mice find them, so we're going to do our best to sort of keep them safe, protected. But
maybe you can eat slugs.
Yeah, right, exactly. We can add slugs to our diet. You
know, we should definitely start integrating that into our garden plan. If we have some good, bug flora, sure, then maybe we could get some edible bugs, start growing those.
Oh, definitely. That'd be a fascinating bug harvest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the worms will turn up the soil for you.
Definitely. So that about does it for this show. Thank you for tuning in to The Food Show for March. A reminder, The Food Show airs the third Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m. I want to thank our guests this month, Chris Leonard, Yvonne Rivero, and Heather Cooley, for joining us on the show. Also, a big thank you to our awesome, awesome, awesome board operator, Tammy.
Go, Tammy.
Hey, Tammy.
Make sure to stay tuned to KBOO for some jazz following this show. I'm Chris Siegel.
And I'm Kate Welch.
I'm Rachel Bennett.
And I'm Peter Schiff.
Thanks for listening.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size or perfect, cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good, cause people need food in their belly. They need some drink for the dying. Everybody's in the same holy boat. People got to have food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry in their throat. A need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right to cut the trees down just to grow a bunch of cheap hamburger meat? You know those trees, they hold the topsoil, and those burgers aren't fit to eat. And you know it ain't right to punish the farmers for growing food clean and poison free. There ought to be a government who protect them, put tax dollars where they need to be. Cause people need food in their belly. They need some drink for the dry in their throat. They need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same.
And that wraps it up for public affairs here at KBOO for the morning. Coming right up, it's Nick Graffro with Jazz Lives. That'll be just after the news noon headlines. Stay tuned for that. Thanks for tuning in today.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, March 19th.
I'm Patrick Wilson.
And I'm Diane Erickson. In local news, a KOMO-TV news helicopter crashed near Seattle Space Needle Tuesday, killing the pilot and a photographer who were on board. One person on the ground is in serious condition. The copter was apparently coming in for a landing when the crash occurred. It struck the side of a building, destroyed several cars on Broad Street, then the copter and cars exploded in flames.
A day-long session was held in Central Point Tuesday morning to sort out the future of rural policing in Oregon. The session was called because dramatic cutbacks in local police forces have occurred as citizens refuse to support legislation to increase taxes to help fund these forces. The cutbacks have resulted in citizen alarm and complaints over how little police presence and protection is currently available in many rural areas in southern Oregon. Limited police presence means significantly less community police coverage and early jail releases for many criminals because of the few officers available to manage local jails.
According to the Oregonian, the state economy is in good health. Unemployment fell from 7% to 6.9% last month for the first time in 5.5 years. In addition, the state has added more jobs than it lost for the past 8 months in a row. The economy is expected to continue to grow modestly for the remainder of 2014.
In national news, 70 members of the House are urging the Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, to halt his current plan to overhaul the nation's poultry inspection system. They are concerned because the law will remove many of the inspectors responsible for federal inspections while simultaneously speeding up production lines. They see this approach as threatening to the safety of employees and the nation's food supply.
On Monday, a statewide campaign in Wyoming, home of the Cheney sisters, was launched to support marriage equality. Four couples and the National Center for Lesbian Rights filed a lawsuit challenging the state's ban on homosexual and lesbian weddings. An appeal will be heard on April 17th in the 10th Circuit Court on a similar case in Oklahoma where a federal judge ruled the state's marriage ban violated the U.S. Constitution. The 10th Circuit covers six states, including Wyoming.
You can be prosecuted in Idaho for secretly filming animals because of a law that makes it a crime to document animal abuse. These laws are proposed for the purpose of punishing animal rights groups and to curtail a form of political speech of great public interest. The statute is being challenged by a coalition of groups, including journalists, as Idaho becomes the seventh state to pass what is called ag-gag laws, where persons who express concern about animal abuse could be accused of violating the law.
A New York man is charged with slipping his pregnant girlfriend abortion pills while they were engaged in sex. Because the woman later experienced intense pain in her abdomen, she went to a local hospital. Doctors removed two pills identified as Cytotec from inside her, and the woman gave birth to a stillborn child a number of hours later. The man was arrested and pleaded not guilty to felony abortion.
In international news, residents of Ecuador are expressing alarm about the deplorable living conditions created by oil giant Chevron, who they are charging, dumped deadly toxin waste in their country. They maintain that Chevron recently discharged 18 tons of oil waste, causing the destruction of valuable rainforest, as well as deaths, miscarriages, and birth defects, thereby threatening some indigenous groups with extinction.
Several NATO AWACS were dispatched Tuesday to monitor the skies over the Ukraine and send a message that the West is watching Russia's aggressive actions. While many Western nations had begun to wonder about the purpose and usefulness of this expensive Western alliance, the Russian incursion into the Ukraine has brought about new life to NATO. So great is the fear of Russia today that some countries would now like to see NATO forces deployed into some of the Baltic states.
Britain has joined with President Obama in sanctioning President Putin for Russia's actions in the Crimea. Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron branded Russia's attempts to annex Crimea as a flagrant breach of international law and completely unacceptable. He warned that Putin would face more serious consequences and promised to push European leaders to further EU sanctions when they meet this Thursday.
This is Diane Erickson
and Patrick Wilson
with the KBOO News at Noon, produced by volunteers in our Southeast studio in Portland, Oregon. Tune in every night at 5 o'clock for more local, national, and international news. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. 91.9 FM in Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM in Philomath and Corvallis, and of course around the world at KBOO.FM. It's time for Jazz Lives, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and Social Justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirectguide.com.